most likely 64, unless he was having an affair with a very short man.
"My dad wasn't having an affair!"
she shouts. And just like that, everything changes. Kit is so loud, the other people in the restaurant look over.
"And my dad wasn't gay, you dumbass!"
"I'm sorry," I say again, and hold up my hands much like she did earlier when it looked like she thought I might hit her. I don't understand what's going on. We went from kissing to yelling in fewer than 3 minutes. I suspected she'd be mad, that I could be ruining things by telling the truth, because that seems to be my downfall, my genetic predilection toward honesty and disclosure. Still, I didn't think it would be like this. I thought Kit was different from the other kids, that she didn't hurl hurtful words, dumbass, idiot, retard, at me just because she could. I was wrong, like usual. But unlike usual, this feels devastating. Like recovering from this moment is impossible. "I'm sorry," I say for a third time. I don't know what I'm apologizing for, other than being too much myself. Kit drops her head onto the table and starts to sob. Her crying is gulpy and wet and unpleasant. I go to pet her hair, because even after all this, even after the dumbass, I still can't help but want to touch her. But then I decide against it. She hates me, and maybe I hate her too. My mind races. We will never eat sandwiches across a table from each other again. And when I think about that, the 73 school days left in which I will now be sitting by myself, how my world will now be kitless, my hands start to flap. I cover one with the other and feel relieved Kit's face is down. I can't let her see this version of me. I recite Pi silently so the balloon in my head doesn't go loose again. I stare at the back of Kit's neck, study the curve of her hairline, imagine drawing it in my mind, imagine tracing it with my fingertip, and I wait.
Chapter 34, Kit. This table smells like French fries, and my cheek feels sticky with someone else's leftover ketchup or maybe jam. Better not to know. I lift my head, take a paper napkin from the dispenser, and dry my drenched face with the little dignity I can still muster. Who knew you could hit bottom twice in one day? "I'm sorry," I whisper, because it's hard to find my voice. I don't want to be the girl who spent the morning sitting in her own vomit and the afternoon crying in public with recycled condiments on my cheek. I want to be better than this. I shouldn't have yelled at you. On the way over to McCormick's, I resolved to be brave and honest. I realize I can't keep going, not like this. My mom wanted us to build and then live in a glass house of lies. But it's time to start throwing rocks. Let it shatter and rain down and cut us all up. I will say these words out loud. The truth. I was driving the car. It was me. No, I cannot say anything. My mouth has gone dry. David stares at my shoulder. His fists are clenched tightly in his lap. He probably wants to throttle my neck. I don't blame him. My mother was wrong to try to bury the truth like it was a physical thing, as if keeping my name out of the newspaper meant it never happened in the first place. My mom's job is to spin things, and so she did what she does best. 10 minutes after a doctor told us my dad had died, she was in action, like the covert superhero I always knew she could be. Mandeep Lowell to the rescue, spinning what had happened into something more easily digestible. "We all know this was an accident," she said to the reporter, a grizzly older man with an unruly white mustache who looked annoyed that our family tragedy had interrupted his dinner plans. Why ruin a 16-year-old girl's life? As if my life hadn't already been ruined. As if reality turned on what people read over breakfast the next morning with their coffee. Let's just leave her out of this, she said. And I stood next to her, totally numb, it never once occurring to me to speak up and object. I'm not asking you to lie, she said. I'd never do that. Just keep it vague enough to let people come to their own conclusions. The next morning, a picture of the accident scene graced the front page of the Daily Courier, and the reporter did exactly as my mother suggested. No mention was made of a second passenger. Anyone who read the article came to the natural conclusion that my father was driving. My mother and I did nothing to correct this wrong impression. One more verbal sleight of hand. Poof! Just like that, I was never in the car. My involvement almost completely erased. There was no follow-up, no additional questioning, just my name on an accident report buried in the bowels of the police station. Apparently, people die in car accidents all the time. My mom said, Dad would have wanted to protect you. I believed her because I wanted to. But we should have started clean, when the whole thing is not sugar-coated with euphemisms like accident, when my mom doesn't pat my back and say, it wasn't your fault, when she doesn't spin the truth. There are words for what I did. Vehicular manslaughter. I don't understand what's happening here, David says. I knew he wasn't driving. I stop, because the tears are getting in the way. I want to do this right, but I'm not naive. Words are not things that can be handed over, simply passed from person to person and let go. They are a string. You're still left holding one end in your hands. There's something I didn't tell you. David can be trusted. He can keep my secrets. He'll help make it better, hold up the other end. Maybe this is what I wanted all along when I started the accident project. For David to find out the truth. For me to finally be exposed and honest. For me to spectacularly self-sabotage and start over. When I was little, my dad used to sing You Are My Sunshine to me before bed. Even that sad second verse no one else seems to know or remember. The other night, dear, while I lay sleeping, I dreamt I held you in my arms. When I awoke, dear, I was mistaken. So I held my head down and cried. The song echoes in my head, in his voice, and it makes me think about David's theory of consciousness. Maybe my dad lives on in something as intangible as song lyrics. Maybe my dad can be with me when I need him. When I awoke, dear, I was mistaken. So I held my head down and cried. Can I sing that as my confession to David? Those are simple words. Easier to say than, I was driving. It was me. I get it, David says before I have a chance to explain myself. Of course. How could I have missed it? I am a dumbass. You were driving. The words come out with enthusiasm. Like he's just aced the SATs, emphasis cheerily on the U. He is smiling and his volume is too loud. This is nothing like those other times, when David's honesty felt good and refreshing, air, underwater. This time, it's sharp and cold and precise, like being stabbed, and he whips my dad's singing right out of my ears. People at the other tables can hear us, I'm sure of it. I need him to stop talking. I need to undo whatever it is I've started. The world begins to spin, and his face morphs from handsome to cruel. I fold over myself. You were driving, right? Your dad was the passenger. It all makes sense. You're exactly 64 inches tall. I can't believe I didn't think of it until now.
He sounds perversely excited, like this is one for the win column, like I should high-five him in celebration. Yay, David! You figured it out! I killed my dad! Please, stop. That's not... I am begging. I can't do this. I can't. Not here. Not like this. With his maniacal grin and booming, self-congratulatory voice. I understand my mother's lies. The truth is too ugly. I want to put our string back in my pocket. What was I thinking? Help me, Dad. I was mistaken. I was mistaken.
I wanted David to tell me that nothing could have been done to stop the car in time. I wanted David to exonerate me. I did not want this. I don't understand why you lied to me, Kit, David says. And then his face morphs again, and now he sounds accusatory. There is no warmth to be found, not even a sliver of compassion or humanity. He's Hannibal Lecter sitting down to an ice cream bowl full of my insides.
Please, please stop. But my words are lost to the formica table. I cannot lift my head. The tears flood my face, but I am not crying anymore. I am what happens after crying. So I held my head down and cried. Where are you, Dad? Where did you go? I can't hear his voice. It is gone.
How could you, Kit?
David demands, as if this has anything to do with him. David.
You're like everyone else. A liar. You were driving that night. It was you. You lied.
David shouts, and then, like in a horror movie, because that's what this has become, my very worst nightmare, everything goes quiet. Someone drops their fork. I hear an audible gasp. I had stupidly expected a soft landing, not free fall. I was wrong yet again, because of course I haven't yet hit bottom. Here it is. Even colder, darker, lonelier than you'd expect. I was mistaken. I turn my head, and that's when I notice Gabriel and Willow in a booth right next to us, eating pancakes covered in whipped cream, the kind of food happy, simple people get to eat. They've heard every single word.
Chapter 35. David. I figured the puzzle out. I did exactly what Kit asked. But it was a setup. A wild goose chase. A lie. Her lie. McCormick's goes quiet, and then there's a collective gasp. A man I've never seen before unfolds his long legs from a nearby booth, comes over to our table. I am supposed to get up and move out of the way, though I don't know why. Kit is leaving open too many questions. Why didn't she trust me with the truth? And doesn't she want to know the math? I have hard numbers for her. Comforting facts and calculations. I stayed up all night for this. The man puts his arms around Kit and starts to walk her out of the restaurant. The whole thing happens so quickly I almost miss it. Kit doesn't look at me. She doesn't say anything except, "Jack?" Like it's a question, even though it's clearly not, because that must be the man's name. He looks like a Jack. I hate him. "I got you, Kitty Cat," he says. Kitty Cat is the perfect nickname for her because cats are confusing and creepily smart and can contort themselves. I can see a cat using the sleeves of a sweater like gloves. "Wait," I say, but they don't stop. Kit looks back at me, one last shocked look, and I see that her face is wet and pale, and for the first time, I can read her eyes, even though I don't want to. And then, only then, when I force myself to make eye contact, do I finally understand what has happened, how and how much I have broken. "Oh, crap," Miney says when I tell her the whole story. "I ran home from McCormick's, so discombobulated I left my car parked in the lot. I am cold and wet from rain and my body is shaking. I'm trying not to lose it because losing it won't help. I don't let myself think about pie. I do not deserve its numbing relief. I also don't allow myself to think about Kit's face because it hurts too much, like being irradiated. I mean, I was so nervous, I forgot rule number 4. Think about the situation from the other person's perspective. Everyone there heard, Miney. Everyone. What am I going to do?" "I don't know," Miney says in a quiet voice. "What do you mean you don't know? You have to know. You have to help me," I say, my voice thick with panic. "I'm not sure I can. Let me get this straight. First, you smiled like you did something good, and then you started yelling at her and accused her of killing her father and other people heard you?" I nod, too ashamed to explain the sequencing of events. I was happy to solve the puzzle, and then heartbroken to learn about the lie, and then, too late, always too late, I realized I was seeing everything upside down. "I screwed up," I say. I notice that Miney's suitcase, which has been open and throwing up clothes all over her floor for the past 2 weeks, is zipped closed and next to the door. She is fully dressed. Her hair is combed and she smells fresh. "Wait, you're leaving? Like right now?" "In a couple of hours. I told you I was going. I've been giving you warnings in daily intervals just like you asked." "But Miney, you can't go. I need you to fix this." "I can't always fix things for you. Honestly, I have to get back to school. I have my own things to fix, David. Please don't call me that." "Okay, sorry, little D. I don't know if she'll forgive you, but I think you know what you need to do. You don't need my help the same way you used to." "Of course I do. Today demonstrates that I absolutely, unequivocally need your help." "No. Today demonstrates that you are still you and you'll occasionally make Aspy mistakes." She takes a quick breath. We've never used the term Aspy between us. And yet, of course, the word fits so much better than David. I'm not sure why I've resisted it for so long. So Asperger's is no longer in the DSM. It doesn't mean it's not at least somewhat descriptive of me. "But look how quickly you figured out what you did wrong. The old you might have not even noticed Kit was upset, or might have insisted that she was being overly sensitive. You're getting better at this empathy thing. Like anything else, it requires practice." "Not for you. Well, don't tell Dad, but I'm basically flunking physics, so, you know, we all have things to work on. Apparently, though, you can learn anything in 10,000 hours.
So in 1.14 years, I might be normal?
Nah, probably not. She smiles at me, squeezes my arm. But normal is way overrated, believe me. I need to apologize to Kit. Yes. Yes, you do. Even though she lied to you. And maybe buy her a present? Like an edible arrangement, or a pair of those odd duck pajamas that you like so much. I stare at Miney's desk. I don't want to look at her suitcase, or at her. She already looks gone. Maybe skip the gift. Everyone likes fruit dipped in chocolate. Trust me on this one. What if she doesn't forgive me? I picture my empty lunch table again. If Kit doesn't forgive me, maybe I could join Jose and Mullet and Chloe's table, which is only 3 over from mine. The new acoustics and perspective would take some getting used to, but I could do it. Although they are not as fun to look at and be with as Kit. Miney shrugs. Kit's loss. There are other girls in the world. Don't go, I say, though I don't really mean it. I am just putting into words the urge I have to throw myself at her legs to keep her from leaving, like I used to do to my mom when I was a little kid. I realize she needs to return to school, that my own feelings on the matter should be irrelevant. By the way, your physics tutor can't be that smart if he doesn't realize how great you are. Miney smiles, the old Miney smile, the kind she used to wear all the time, and then she envelops me in a huge hug. Though I don't feel like being hugged, I let her, because she's my sister, and my favorite person in the world, and in a few hours, she'll be far, far away. I love you, little D, just the way you are. So yeah, you can change, but don't ever really change, okay? Okay, I agree, though I have no idea what that means at all. I'm scared, Miney. All the best people are, she says.
Chapter 36, Kit. People are surprisingly nice to you when they discover you killed your father. I announce at lunch, toying with a new persona now that my secret is out. Jokey, as if I'm not drowning in shame, as if treating this as something light can make it bounce right off me. I'm, of course, back at my old table. I haven't seen David since McCormick's. Jack, who always seems to appear just when I do and do not need him the most, was somehow miraculously at the restaurant with Evan. He drove me home. I was too shaken to register that it was my first time seeing him since my mother's confession. For that 5-minute ride, he was Uncle Jack, and he delivered me to my mother, who took one look at my face and went straight to the bathroom cabinet to get me a Valium. What happened in McCormick's went viral, just like David's notebook, though in my case through texts and whispered conversations. You can still Google my name without finding a thing. Stop saying that, Violet says, though she doesn't flinch. Both she and Annie spent all of Sunday on my couch, after showing up at my house armed with pizza and a jumbo-sized bag of M&Ms. At first, I didn't say a word, and they didn't ask. We just sat and ate and watched television. And instead of resenting them, I appreciated that they were being delicate with me. Remembered that they had always been my tribe. Only later did the words start to form, and once I started talking, I found I couldn't stop. My dad and I both wanted a Snickers bar, I said, staring straight ahead. I couldn't bring myself to look at them. That's why we went out that night. But we told my mom we were just going to get milk. And my dad made me drive, because he wanted me to get extra practice. You want to hear the strangest thing? The accident happened on the way home.
and the milk carton was still sitting in the back seat. Not crushed, not even like a little bit dented. So weird. I still have half of the Snickers bar. I keep it on my desk like some sick souvenir.
It would be totally inappropriate of me to make a no use crying over spilt milk joke, right? Annie asked. And for reasons I can't explain, both Violet and I thought that was hilarious. And we laughed until we all had tears running down our faces. I realized then that maybe humor could help me through. Another way to bend time. It was an accident. It really wasn't your fault, Annie says. This is their new favorite mantra, again with the words accident and fault, as if they are made of magic. I am absolved. Poof. It's all better. I don't mind hearing it because I need everything I can get. I shouldn't have waited so long to talk to my friends. They've been so supportive. The opposite of David. I don't get why your mom wanted you to keep it a secret in the first place, Violet says. She was just trying to protect me, I say. And then I can't help it. I reflexively look over to David's table. But he's not there. He's a few rows over with the kids from Academic League. He catches me looking, and I quickly turn my attention back to the girls. If no one knew, then maybe it wouldn't define me. And you know my mom, she's totally hardcore about everything. She makes me drive to school every day and run all sorts of errands because she's worried that driving will become a thing for me, like a phobia. Is it working? Annie asks. Sort of, I say. I still get a little shaky in the car, but it gets a tiny bit easier each time. I have already warned my friends that the girl they used to know and love is gone, that they should give up trying to revive the old me. I'm not braver or stronger as my mom hoped. I'm a new version. Possibly someone they could one day like better, who knows? Maybe I'll turn out funnier. My mom has found me a therapist who specializes in grief counseling, and she got herself one too. She's even talking about us seeing a third psychologist we can talk to together. We are mobilizing. Vi and I have decided to go stag to prom, and we'll be taking Uber, no driving needed, so will you come with us, just us girls? Annie asks. Please, please, please. Sorry, I can't, I say. Why not? If I can go and watch Gabriel and Willow make out all night, you can at least come and pretend to have fun. I shrug. My dad would have been excited about prom. He would have taken 1,000 pictures of me and posted them on Facebook without my permission and begged me to text him the DJ's playlist. Come on, Violet whines. Sorry, guys. It's David, isn't it? Forget about him. He's a weirdo, Annie says. Obvi, we're no longer Team David. This is not about David, I say. Though maybe it is, just a little bit. Because perhaps for a second there, before David was the enemy, I had pictured both of us dressed up and slow dancing to some cheesy song. I had pictured another night just like at Dylan's party, when he looked at me like I was something worth looking at, when I allowed myself to forget. After what happened at McCormick's, he sent me only one text. It was composed of two words. I'm sorry. I might have killed my father, but I think even I deserve better than that.
Chapter 37. David. I spend the first week after screwing everything up with Kit, too ashamed to do anything except write her a stupid text. I keep it short, limit it to the words I know can't be the wrong ones. I'm sorry. I don't trust myself not to make a bigger mess of things by saying more. Whenever I pick up the phone to text again, I freeze up with anxiety. I don't feel like I deserve the chance to explain. I don't even deserve to share the same air molecules as Kit. I have spent all my waking hours following rule number 4 by trying to imagine what she must be thinking. My guess is she assumes I am a sociopath. I smiled. At McCormick's, while we were talking about the accident, one in which she was driving and her father was a passenger, one that resulted in her father's death. I smiled. And then I had the nerve to yell. Since I am in my own brain, I understand why I did all that. The sequencing makes perfect sense to me. But to her, a person on the outside of my mind, a person who knows nothing about my synaptic responses, I must seem like a monster. Here's what happened in that booth, with Kit sitting across from me and the cold milkshake in my stomach and the strange dimensions of my new clothes. My brain got narrow. It did what it's best at. It tunneled in. If that moment was a Russian nesting doll, I was paying attention to the smallest figurine, pawing my way through the details of blood spatter and break data and an algorithm I had elegantly designed. I found an answer, right there, at the very center, a tiny nugget. That's all I could see. The solution to a mathematical equation that had been troubling me for weeks, the missing data point. I did not see all the other metaphorical dolls. The one wrapped around the smallest one, and the one wrapped around the next smallest one, and the next after that. What neurotypical people call the context. I did not see Kit, or the people nearby, or the delicate nature of what we were discussing. Honestly, I did not see anything else at all. David, if I gave up every time I pissed someone off, I wouldn't have any friends either, Trey says a week later, after I've told him the whole sad story, even the parts that are hard for me to admit in the retelling. Our lesson today will be 100% about social skills, since I am so shaken up about Kit I don't even bother to take out my guitar. She probably won't forgive me, I say. Maybe not, but you have to at least try. And if you really do your best to apologize and she doesn't forgive you, then you move on. You messed up. It happens. There will be other girls, man. Not really. I mean, of course, there are other girls in the world, but by definition, there's no one else exactly like Kit, with her precise genetic and environmental makeup. I regret that I left my guitar in the closet. My hands want to move. The strings would come in handy. What's the worst thing that can happen if you try? Trey asks. I make her hate me even more. I humiliate myself again. I spin out and crawl into the fetal position and start rocking in front of the entire school. I see you've given this a lot of thought. You're not helping, I say. How about this? You can't control how she reacts, but you can control what you do. So you do you. Be your best and hope for the best. I am paying you $40 an hour, and all you can come up with is you do you? I ask. Your parents are paying me, smartass. Fair enough, I say, because it's true. They are. And so 5 full days after my conversation with Trey, 5 days in which I apply my Russian nesting doll focus to winning Kit's friendship back, 5 days in which I think hard about what it means for me to do me, though I'm not sure the expression can be converted from second to first person, I am ready to put my plan into action. I start with food. After all, we met at my lunch table.
Chapter 38, Kit. The following Monday, I come home to find an insulated cooler on my doorstep with my name scrawled across the top. Inside is a huge container of homemade chicken tikka masala and white rice. The note attached has no words, just three seemingly identical sketches of me in which I look sadder and prettier than I do in real life. Of course, I know immediately they are David's, but it takes me a minute to notice the differences between them. In the first, the freckles on my chest are their normal shape, almost but not quite a circle. In the second, David has rearranged them into the shape of pi. In the third, they form the infinity symbol. I tack the three me's up on the back of my closet door in a line, my sketched faces turned toward my hanging clothes, a place where only I will see them, me transformed into art. That night, my mother and I eat David's food at the counter in the kitchen. We sit on our neighboring stools, the weight of truth nestled in the space between us. We are slowly growing used to honesty in this house, accepting the million different ways it unzips your skin and leaves you vulnerable. We are trying to be open to the terrifying possibility of being understood, and the opposite too, which is so much scarier, opening ourselves to the terrifying possibility of not being understood at all. The chicken is delicious, almost as good as my grandmother's, and way better than Curryland's. On Tuesday, I open my locker to find a fat, dusty book, an old edition of the DSM. There's a big post-it note and an arrow pointing to the section titled Asperger's Syndrome. I'm pretty sure I have Asperger's. This is an old DSM. The new one folds my diagnosis under autism spectrum disorders. I think this will tell you a lot about why I am the way I am and why I acted the way I acted, though I can't use the Aspie thing as an excuse. It's more an explanation than an excuse. There's a famous expression that if you've met one person with autism, then you've met one person with autism. So you met me. Just me. Not a diagnosis. I realize I hurt you. I forgot to think about you first. I did not put myself in your shoes, as the expression goes. Though, as a sidebar, I think wearing other people's shoes is kind of disgusting. I'm only okay with the concept metaphorically. So you know, you are all I think about. P.S. I recommend you change your locker combination for security purposes, but not till next week. I guessed your code on only my fifth try. On Wednesday, in class, three tickets to a Princeton basketball game fall out of my laptop, with yet another note and another drawing. This time, I am sitting in the bleachers of a crowded game next to Annie and Violet. I don't look sad. Instead, I'm grinning, and there's something about my hair. It's loose around my shoulders and falling in a perfect pattern that makes me look liberated somehow. Because you said you loved spectator sports. You think I'm the weird one. That was a joke, by the way, even though I'm not sure if I'm allowed to joke with you yet. Probably not, since we haven't spoken out loud to each other since the McCormick's incident. This is my new life goal, by the way, to one day have permission to make you laugh again. On Thursday, in my mailbox, a bonsai tree. You said your dad loved this kind of tree. I thought slash hoped maybe you did too. On Friday, I opened my locker to find a new sketch taped to the inside. The picture is of two numbers, 137 and 139, but they are drawn to look human. 139 has a backpack like David's and his new short hair. 137 carries a shoulder bag like mine, and it wears a big man's shirt just like my dad's. The numbers walk down Clancy Street holding hands. I just wanted you to know these are my favorite numbers,
and my favorite twin primes, 137 and 139. And since they are my favorite, I wanted to give them to you. 137 and 139. They're yours now. Please take good care of them. On Saturday, when I check my inbox, I have an email from David with the subject, "This gives me hope." It links to an article about a Russian scientist who has, under lab conditions, created two identical snowflakes. I smile goofily at the screen. On Sunday, David leaves an old-fashioned emergency crank radio on my front porch. "So we can always hear each other's waves. Clearly, I need one of these more than you, but buying myself a gift did not seem in the spirit of this multi-step apology." On Monday, after last period, Annie stops me from getting into my car. My hands are trembling a little, like they always do before I get into the driver's seat. But this time, I don't try to hide them. "David asked me to give this to you," she says, and hands over a piece of paper that looks ripped from his notebook. I look at her, a question in my eyes. What should I do? She shrugs. "It never mattered before what I thought of David. It shouldn't now," she says, and gives me a go-get-em shoulder punch. I unfold the paper. "Kit Lowell. Height, 5 feet 4 inches. Weight, approximately 125 pounds. Wavy brown hair, pulled into a ponytail on test days, rainy days, and most Mondays. Skin is brownish because her dad, a dentist, is white, and her mom is Indian, Southeast Asian, not Native American. Class ranking, 14. Activities, school newspaper, Spanish club, pep club." I've read all of it before when his words first found their way onto the internet from his stolen notebook. But now there is a big X through the entire entry, and written over it, in all caps, "Favorite girl in the world. Still my friend? Please meet me on the bleachers after school. Please. And I'm sorry. Sorrier than any person has ever been sorry in the history of sorry people. I'll put in one last please for good luck, even though I don't believe in luck. I believe in science. Sorry. Again."
Chapter 39. David. I wait in the bleachers, in the exact same spot we sat on that first day when Kit was just Kit Lowell to me, an entry in a notebook and someone I cautiously put on the trust list. A few notable encounters, nothing more. Now it occurs to me that outside of Miney, she's the first friend I've ever made. If she doesn't come, I will be heartbroken. Not literally, of course. My heart will continue to beat, I think. But there will be a literal and figurative ache. I close my eyes and remember our first kiss, how she reached up and cupped the back of my neck. That feels like much longer than 14 days ago. Time has changed shape since I met Kit. Can love be so powerful a force that it can skew the space-time continuum? Does it have the particle and wave heft of something like consciousness? I make a mental note to later think through the implications of applying quantum theory to love, or at least its chemical and hormonal approximations. That could make for a satisfying thesis for my future PhD. She's not coming. It's obvious to me that this past week will turn out to have been just a fruitless series of desperate acts. I watch my classmates spilling out of school, in groups of two or three, their formations intimidatingly organic, atoms into molecules. Like usual, I am alone. My headphones sound a siren call from my bag. I force myself to leave them in there. I will wade through all the noise around me, let it saturate my brain. The distant bell, car engines revving, the anxiety humming through my body. It was a long shot, and I lost. Kit doesn't need more friends, certainly not ones like me. I direct my attention to the remote possibility that Trey is right, that one day I won't need Kit, that I will find a way to fill up my life with other people, that there are other girls in the world, and that maybe one of them will also feel like my Goldilocks of a person. Of course, all statistics point to Kit being an outlier, to this never happening again. I close my eyes, and I can't resist any longer. I slip on my headphones and start the gentle recitation of Pi. David? 134 digits in, I look up, and there Kit is, standing in front of me, looking exactly the same as she always does. There is no readjustment to a new iteration. That, at least, is a relief. She's not smiling. The sky is low and gray and bloated. If this were a novel, it would be described as foreboding. Hi, I say, and take off my headphones. I realize I am woefully underprepared for this moment. I should have written a speech, or drawn a picture, at least figured out what I wanted to say. It occurs to me now that I never thought Kit might actually show up. Do you want to sit? She nods and plops down next to me on the bench. She shields her eyes from the non-existent sun with a cupped hand. We sit quietly like that for a few minutes. So? She asks. You asked me to come here? Do you ever think about how your name doesn't fit you? I mean, you're usually Kit in my head, but really I think your name should have a Z in it, because you're confusing and zigzagged and pop up in surprising places, like my lunch table and these bleachers. I really didn't think you'd come. And maybe also the number 8, because... never mind. And the letter S, too. It's my favorite. S. So, yeah, Z8S-139... or 139-Z8S. That's how I think of you sometimes. In my head, I say, glad that words are at least coming out of my mouth. I'm too nervous to evaluate whether they are the right ones. I don't know if I can do this, Kit says. I keep going. And my name doesn't fit either. I mean, really, David? Did you know there are approximately 3,786,417 Davids in the United States? My parents couldn't have gotten me more wrong. I should be I don't know what. Something with a Y in it. I literally have no idea what you're talking about right now. What I'm trying to say, badly, I guess, is that we each have the way the world sees us. And you were the very first person at this school, maybe the first person pretty much anywhere besides my immediate family, who looked at me and saw more than the weirdo flapping kid that everyone here is known as David, or I guess shithead. You listened to me talk, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. It was like the equivalent of being given a better name. She nods. And I wonder if she will get up and leave and we are done. Not friends, not enemies. I tell myself I can count that as a win. I mean, are we just not going to talk about what happened? Your kind of weird wasn't good or charming the other day. It was cruel. You hurt me, Kit says. And I don't really care what your name is. Stop changing the subject. We never started on the subject. Kit sighs, so I clear my throat. Begin again. You're right. I'm so sorry. I can try to explain what happened, I mean with my brain, because I hope you know I would never, ever, ever be intentionally cruel, especially to you. You're my favorite person. The thing is, I get hyper-focused, and that's what I was thinking about. The nugget inside, the answer, not what it all meant, actually. Does that make sense? Kit shrugs, a gesture that is in my mental pictorial dictionary of ambiguous gestures, and I don't know what to do, if I should keep talking or stop. I'm sorry, and I hope you can forgive me, I say, and I turn to look at her. Not her clavicle, or her jaw, or her left arm, but right in the eyes, where it's hardest. I don't know, I guess, Kit says, but she's the one to look away first. That doesn't mean, though, that, like, we are suddenly besties again or something. We were best friends? I ask. Of course she's mine, excepting Miney, who is family and therefore doesn't count. Never thought I would count as hers, though. I just mean I know I was the one who asked you to start the accident project in the first place. I know that. The whole thing was super messed up. I know I didn't tell you the truth, or at least not the whole truth. But you shouted out my biggest secret. The worst thing that has ever happened to me. The worst thing that will hopefully ever happen to me. To the whole world. Like it was nothing. Like you didn't give a crap about my feelings. I'm sorry. Not just for the shouting, or how inappropriate I was. I do stupid things like that sometimes. I am sorry for all that, of course. But what I'm most sorry for is that any of it happened to you in the first place, and that I haven't said that out loud to you. It's not fair. The fact that you were driving that car, the inexplicable cruelness of that bad luck, is the only thing in the world that I can think of that can't be explained by math or quantum theory. See, I don't usually use words like bad luck, and yet there are some things so totally out of our control that science hasn't even come up with a label for them. And they suck. And you don't deserve any of it. The accident wasn't your fault. Even the math says, okay, she says, cutting me off like it's some sort of decision, like she's uninterested in my fault algorithm. Of course, I have no idea what that decision is, or if it has anything to do with me at all. You couldn't have braked. There was nothing you could have done, I say, thinking this is the one last gift I can hand over, even if she's not sure she wants to hear it. After this, I'm all out. No more food or drawings. It's me. Of course I could have braked. I could have been faster with my foot. There must have been a moment. That's all I wanted to know. The when, so I could see it differently. Even if it was just in my mind, she says, looking out into the distance. I follow her gaze, but don't know what she's staring at. All of Mapleview, I guess. No, you really couldn't have. If you'd braked, then everything would have been worse. Someone else would have died too, Kit. There was a mini behind you, so if you stopped short, that car would have been crushed from two different sides. Both cars would have been hit. I can show you the model in the simulation I made if you want. I don't think so, Kit says. I mean, thank you, but there are some things I just can't. This wasn't your fault, mathematically or legally. There's nothing you could have done. So instead of trying to watch it happen differently, why don't you try to not watch it at all? She looks up at me, her face full, but I don't know of what. I didn't meet her. The woman driving the mini. I don't even know her name. You saved her life, I say. Maybe, she says, and nods, but she's again like water. Her smile is slippery and starts to fall off her face. Thank you. Again. This was really nice of you. You saved her life, I repeat, because I don't think she's hearing my certainty that this is a fact. You really think so? She asks. I don't think so. I know so. Math doesn't lie. People do, though, Kit says. All the time. Not me. No, not you, she says, and her smile firms up a little. So we're friends again? Sure. I mean, we don't have to sit at the same lunch table. You looked happy back with Annie and Violet, but it would be cool if we still talked sometimes. Like at school during other periods. Of course we can talk, she says, and I feel my stomach fill with relief. I have not lost everything. Just to be clear, I assume that there will be no more kissing, I ask. She laughs, loud and hard, and it feels as good as it did the very first time I made her laugh. When it comes to Kit's laughter, I don't care much about my intentionality. We'll see about that. So, there might be? She elbows me, a friendly nudge, I think, and I nudge back. I take this to mean a warm, no, thank you. Right. How about hand-holding? Can we do that? I ask. David? Right, I'll stop talking. We can just sit here quietly together.
That would be a good idea.
Okay, I say.
Thank you,
she says.
Chapter 40. Kit. David and I are sitting in the bleachers, and all of Mapleview is spread out before us like a restaurant menu. And it's that hour in a late winter day when everything turns the same color of washed-out gray. The air is so thick. I feel like I could slice it and serve it like pie. Our small town looks even smaller from up here. I let his words settle over me. The idea that I couldn't have changed a thing. There is math to point to. A model on his computer, apparently. I don't know yet how I feel about any of this. Whether this changes things. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe there is no such thing as relief for me. Only time. I'm sure David has quantum theories to point to. The unraveling of our future selves. The existence of alternate universes. How healing can occur on a molecular level. I don't, though. I think it's all so much simpler than that. My dad was right. Unimaginably bad shit happens. We are left to choose whether to grow or to wither, to forgive or to fester. I'm going to choose to grow and forgive, for both myself and my mom. She deserves the same grace. I look over at David and he looks over at me, and he smiles, and then so do I. We turn around again and face outward. I think for some reason of those three portraits now hanging in my closet. My chest tattooed with freckled possibility. Pi. Infinity. One open. One closed. Both forever. The thought makes me feel lighter, closer to whole. Bigger somehow. 139-Z8S, I ask? Really? Or, if you prefer, I can call you Z8S-139, or Z8 for short. I'll think about it, I say.
Looking at him now, I realize he's right. He's not a David, not even a little bit. What should I call you then? He shrugs.